Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics? What's happening? Where are we at? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Thank you for joining me. Today on the show, Horatio Sanz from, you know him from SNL and from places. He's got a podcast called The Horatio over there on Earwolf. And well, let's get up to speed. Let's talk about the anxiety for a minute, because I have to apologize to many of you. Some of you who are my friends, if you listen, you know, some of you who are my friends who listen to this occasionally, and but have probably muted me on Twitter. I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm not going to do any investigating. I'm about done. I'm about out. But I'm about out. I'm going off the Twitter grid. But this is the Christmas, holiday, Hanukkah seasonal things happening around, getting Christmas cards from people that I don't know, or maybe I just don't know them anymore. Perhaps it's gotten to that point where I'm like, is that kid all grown up? Who are these people? That doesn't look like the same husband. That's not the same wife. Where'd those three kids come from? It's strange how Christmas cards change. But I think I'm getting some from people I don't know, unless my memory is really fucked up. The point I'm trying to make is I do nothing. And I'm embarrassed about it. I don't send out cards. I did, you know, when I was with different women who would, we, you know, get a, you know, sort of a jump on it. You know, let's do this. Let's send a few out. I do nothing and I feel bad about it. I didn't send out any cards and I feel bad if people get cards. I didn't have a holiday party. I didn't light one goddamn Hanukkah candle. And I don't know if it's important. I don't know. I was thinking about this morning. Like, I know that when people get things, they're like, oh, they sent a thing. But if you don't get it, are you like, that fucker didn't send a thing? If you haven't established that you're sending things. But I'm bad, man. I mean, I don't send my nephews or nieces anything. I don't send my parents anything. I don't send my brother anything. Some part of me thinks that this podcast is enough, that it covers everything. That, like, if anyone is, if my family listens, merry stuff. Happy Hanukkah. I didn't send a thing. You know, I barely get my, if I'm with a woman, which I am, I have to remember to get them shit. It's so, I don't know if it's selfish or I really just don't, I'd like to frame it that, you know, like, holidays are bullshit. But no matter how many times you say that, then you got to sell that to the person that you're not buying presents for or not acknowledging. I mean, and I've been through a lot here at the house. I mean, I've had Christmas trees in there, people. I've had Christmas lights. I've lit candles. I've had a lot of things have gone on in there, holiday related. There's been decorating. There's been many presents. There's been no presents. But now I don't even think about it. What the fuck am I thinking about if I'm not thinking about the holidays? I didn't watch the Democratic debate. I didn't go see Star Wars. I knew it was coming. I knew everything was happening. What am I fucking doing with my time? Well, have a safe holiday. Try to be kind to the people in your life, even the ones that you have no choice about, even the ones that are annoying. Give people a little card or or a piece of cake or something makes a big difference. Say thank you. If you get a present for somebody, don't linger, like, and go and then talk them out of, you know. I just had that happen yesterday. I bought a hat, some gloves, because we're going to go on a chilly trip for a few days. And Sarah did not give me the response that I was waiting for. So I bullied her, basically. Well, you know, if you don't, you know, if you want, you can take them back if you want. Hey, if you're not going to wear them, I mean, if it's not your style, I mean, if it doesn't, if it is, does it fit? Do they fit? Is it something you're going to wear? I mean, I just bought those. And if you're just going to put them in a drawer somewhere, and I put things in drawers all the time and never look at them. Wow, that swag though. But I just sort of like, well, are you to the point where she's like, no, no, no. And she bought me a beautiful Filson duffel bag. Now, granted, I did pay for this little adventure we're going on, but that's not the point. It's about giving. But it's not only about giving, it's about the person you're giving to act excited, surprised, perhaps use or wear what you got them as immediately as possible, even if it's only once. It's about maybe bringing it up again and going like, wow, these are really great. This is really great. I remember years ago, I had bought a girlfriend a sweater, and it was not her style at all. It was not anything she would wear. And in my mind, I had somehow convinced myself, because that's what you do in that moment. You have a moment with a thing and you're like, oh, that's an amazing thing. That's beautiful. I'm going to get that for her because in my mind, I'll make her into the person that wears that. I'll make him into the person that wears that. I don't think that's your intention. But this sweater was completely years ago. And she took it out of the box and she was like, what am I going to do with this? And I thought, I don't know, maybe, you know, wear it until it gets ratty and shitty like your other clothes. And then it'll be perfect because it'll look like an old one of those sweaters. But I think in my mind, I wanted her to be the kind of person that wore that sweater. And that's where Al-Anon comes in 40 years later. However many years it took me to understand that shit. I'm not promoting anything here, folks. Just don't buy presents for people with hopes that they'll fit your expectations of those gifts. Does that make sense? Does it? Let me give you a brief synopsis or a little bit of what I know. The last time I talked to you, it was Monday morning or maybe Sunday night in Chicago, about to shoot this amazing thing I did with Joe Swanberg, who's just a great guy and a nice guy, not an affected guy, decent fella, and an amazingly gifted film director. And he's a complete auteur. He does his own thing entirely, and it has its own style and feel. And I love the guy. I loved him before he hired me. And it's all improvising. And I know that you've seen shows that are like that, where it's sort of like, yeah, it's all improvised. It's kind of intense, man, to just go. And I was working with Jane Addams. Jane fucking Addams. I love Jane Addams. What a great actress. And so funny. And we were like, you know, she's one of those people, you know, there's people in your lives. I've had a few people on the show like that. I just feel like I've known my whole fucking life. I don't know why. Well, Jane Addams is one of those people. And we improvised these scenes. She was my best friend. It was amazing. And then I did those scenes with Emily Ratajkowski, and those turned out to be great. Because it was exactly what Swanberg wanted. This gaping age difference. Let's see how Mark does a character engaging with 25-year-olds. Andrew Batchelor, who's a comedian, was another one of the younger people. But I had a great time. And improvising like that, because then you have to improvise when it's really all improvised and all you're going with is what needs, you know, sort of the things you have to, what sort of needs to happen in the scene, is that you go through emotions that are surprising to you. I mean, like, I chose not to control my emotions and move through sort of the interactions with whoever I'm working with. And it was sort of mind blowing to realize that, yes, I'm old. I'm 52 years old. It's not old, but there's a difference, you know, generational differences, exciting things. I don't know what I'm trying to tell you. I'm just trying to tell you that what you're seeing when you see this thing is like actual immediate emotional reacting to other actors without really knowing where it's going to go. And I know I do that a lot. I do that on stage. I do that here and there. I do it right now. I'm doing it right now. And as you know, for those of you who are still listening, this sometimes can just, you know, spiral off into nothing. But not usually when there's another person here. But anyways, it was a great time and a great experience. I want to thank Joe Swanberg and all the people involved with that thing, because it was really the first thing I had ever done like that. Yeah, I do my own TV show, but it was great to be working with a guy who you trust, a good guy, doing something exciting and new. Do that if you can, maybe over the holidays. Huh? Right now, it's my pleasure to have my guest here in the garage. I'm going to talk to the very funny and decent Horatio Sanz. Finally, dude.
Yeah.
Right?
Pleasure to be here.
It's nice to see you. I mean, I canceled, you canceled. I mean, it was like, but like not just once. I mean, what is, we've been trying to do this for a year?
At least. Maybe three.
Has it been that long? What happened last time? It sounded pretty interesting. It sounded like some international intrigue. Oh. The last time you canceled, there was some issues with your green card.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I had to get my green card renewed.
Oh,
yeah.
All right, yeah.
So I had to go to New York and be there. They wouldn't take any kind of submission online or anything.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Is that the first time you've had to have it renewed?
No, I think it's every 10 years.
So is it a surprise to you? Like, oh, fuck.
It's never a surprise, but it is like the only thing that's kind of serious in my life. Like, shit, I got to get this done or else they're going to kick me out of here.
And then you have to go back to where?
To Chile, I guess. And I don't really know Chile, so that'd be kind of weird.
So how does that work? How are you not a citizen?
I just,
not that I don't want you here. I'm just...
No, thank you.
Yeah.
No, my parents just, they conceived me in Chicago, and I had two older brothers at the time.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, let's just go back and have him be born Chilean also, so he won't
they
be the
flew back
one.
To have you?
To they make... flew back to Chile to have me born a Chilean citizen.
And then they flew back to Chicago?
Yes. Like 2 months after but I was
if
born.
They... If they just had you here, it would have been okay. You would have been a citizen.
I would have been a citizen, yeah.
That doesn't seem
and
like...
now I can't be president.
Nah, by the time... Yeah, you could. I guess you... Well, you
want... Well, I wasn't born here, though. You can't be president if you're born here, if you're not born here.
Well, I'm sorry. Was that a big disappointment for you, or...
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you're growing up, you want to have that option open.
Sure. Now, maybe
I never did.
Did you cause you a lot of trouble? You think it made you self-sabotage or have an anger issue or anything, the not being able to be president thing?
It may have.
Yeah.
It may be why I have a rebellious spirit.
Wow. Maybe we got to the bottom of it this quickly.
That's awesome.
Which is, I don't know what else we have to talk about.
Yeah, let's just load this up with commercials and get out of here.
Wait, so you've never spent any time in Chile?
I did when I was five. They tried to move back.
Really?
Yeah, so I spent a year at school, and I think it was first grade.
They tried to move back. But
by then, my older brothers were really missed America, so we went back.
Your parents seemed to be a little waffling on the...
Yeah.
You can't commit to a decision, really.
Well, they're Chilean immigrants, so when they came to the United States, their options weren't they didn't have as many options as they did in Chile.
Right. What'd they do there?
Well, my dad was, my dad taught school in Brazil, I mean, in Venezuela and in Chile, and my mother worked as a nurse at a hospital. And when they came here, none of that mattered.
Right.
So my dad worked at a hotel as a bartender and a waiter.
Yeah.
And my mother worked at a factory making lottery tickets.
Making lottery tickets?
Yeah, like those scratch opens that from Portland.
Yeah.
You know, those.
The scratch things.
She made the scratch things.
With the little things you rub off with a coin or your finger, depending how desperate you are.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Fuck, I don't have a coin.
You're the pick.
Everything's hanging on this.
This
the
is
last,
it.
The last dollar on this scratch card. And that's what they did your entire childhood?
Yeah, pretty much. And then when I was in high school, my dad started going back to college because he had a college degree from Chile that didn't transfer. So he went to college and became a drug counselor for a little bit.
Oh, really?
Before he retired, yeah.
Interesting. Just out of nowhere, or did somebody...
he just kind of always wanted to, and finally just, you know, had enough time and was retiring, and so he did that.
And you have two older brothers?
Yeah.
What'd they end up doing?
Well, my brother Steve ended up, he was running, he bought a dating service, and he was running that in Vegas.
An internet dating service?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And this is before the internet. No, it was before. It was videotape.
Really?
Yeah.
So he was getting the, you know, like people would make, like, hey, my name's John. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's your favorite thing to do on a date?
And, oh, really?
Know, stuff was, like that.
Was this a national service or something local?
It was Chicago mostly, and then it was Vegas.
What happened to it went to Vegas? Sounds like it got dodgy. You know, it wasn't quite hard to define whether it was just a dating service then.
Oh, well, the problem may have lied in the fact that it wasn't a full dating service.
Oh, what?
It was a real dating, you know, real dating service. Oh. Which, you know, I guess just...
Fizzled out?
It fizzled out, yeah. And then he did some stuff with real estate, and then now I think he's working.
What happened to all those great videos of desperate people?
We have them.
Looking
think
for
they're,
love.
They're in my parents' garage.
Oh, good. He kept them, huh?
Yeah, we got them.
You should digitize those fuckers. See how those people WikiLeaks. Are doing.
Put those on WikiLeaks.
Sure, man. Just put them on YouTube. Hey, remember that?
That'd be so terrible.
Oh,
for them.
Boxes of videotapes sitting in garages. You got any of those?
I don't know. I made them too. I used to ask the questions. See, well, we both worked for the guy who owned it in Chicago, and then he ended up buying the business from the guy in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. So you were in the position of the executive. You were the casting guy.
Yeah, I was the casting. I was
directing.
I was the whole, the directing.
Hey, could you look more less desperate? More like.
Yeah, sometimes I would say, like, yeah, relax. Don't, you know, you're sweating a lot.
Oh, really?
Maybe turn off the heat here. I mean, turn on the air conditioning and get them kind of ready.
Yeah. How old were you when that was happening?
I was 20. 21, 22.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the other brother up to?
He's an actor, and he does mostly serious films and
shows.
So
he's out here?
Yeah, he's out here. He lives in between Koreatown and Larchmont over there. He plays drug dealers in a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like,
because he's swarthy and handsome and tall.
And South American.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that
not a typecast situation. Has he done some big movies?
He did that one with Stratham where he needs to be like... You know,
in a car?
He's on a car. He can't stop the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What the hell
is
that
called?
He's
got a mechanical heart.
No, he has some kind of drug has been given to him where he has to keep his heart rate above a certain...
Oh, am I making it up that there's some sort of ticking time bomb that if his heart doesn't... Like, there's... I thought it was a mechanical heart or something. That it was not a realistic movie.
No, it wasn't.
He had to plug like a car battery into his heart. Am I making that up?
At some point, I think he did have to do something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw
so
parts
I'm not
of
sure
that
he's
movie.
Got a mechanical heart, but he's definitely dealing with some kind of new drug that's been invented by some bad guys.
They took his heart out or something, and they put...
I'll put a fake one in it? Yeah. Hey, maybe. I forget the
But I remember the bad guys were Asian in that, kind of, and there was
Well, maybe you're
Asian...
mixing up the movies then.
Yeah.
This one's Crank. Oh. This
yeah, that was
Crank.
The one. Yeah, that's the one I saw.
Well, maybe you thought my brother looked Asian.
No, he was another guy. There was another guy that a big guy that gets into a big sort of fight, and he's got guns. And
no, my brother's the pimp. He's not a pimp, but he was the drug dealer. He fell out of a window and into a pool and died.
Oh,
yeah, like a real good send off.
Oh shit, I don't. It must be the movie I saw. How many movies could like where he's got to keep his heart rate up? It's like no, that's not the one where he's got the electric heart. Or the battery heart.
Well, this is what we thought about Fast and the Furious, and 12 films later.
Maybe that was, I'm thinking of Crank 2?
You might be, yeah.
Maybe you're right. I got to get caught up on that shit. I miss everything. So Chicago's a fucking great city. I've grown to appreciate it.
Yeah, I liked a lot of it. And mostly, the arts kind of flourished there.
Right.
For me, they kind of... You know, the idea that Second City was in the same town that I was in was always exciting.
When did you become aware of that, though?
Oh, I was little because SNL. When I used to watch SNL with my brothers in their room.
How much older are they?
They're 6 and 9 years older.
Wow. So you're an accident.
Yeah, I'm an accident for sure.
Yeah.
A happy accident.
Catholic accident.
They weren't really Catholic, but...
Oh, See, I just made an assumption. Chilean, Spanish, Catholic.
I think we should have been, but my father was agnostic.
Oh, that's good.
And no, pretty strongly against religion.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's fucking beautiful. It's nice to hear that.
Yeah, so from, I had that too.
From someone of Latino background. Is it still Latino?
Yes.
Am I being condescending?
No.
Okay. I just, I'm not.
And it's coming up a lot.
Yeah, what is? Latino?
Latino, what is Latino or Hispanic?
Oh, yeah?
Hispanic means that it's derived from Spain, and Latino is all different.
Oh.
Spanish.
It's broader. It's more broad.
Mexican and everybody else, South America. Yeah.
But Hispanic can fall under the Latino umbrella.
Yes.
Oh, so Hispanic's out.
Not really, no.
No,
no, but I think Latino is the better.
Yeah, you might not take any chances.
Yes.
And if somebody gets defensive and goes, I'm Hispanic, you're like, no, you're a racist.
Yeah.
Because you want to separate yourself from the rest of the Latino people.
Or you can say Horatio says Latino's cool now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're dated, retro.
Yeah.
With your Hispanic, why don't you just say... Why don't you just say you're a cholo? Is that still in cholos? Are there still cholos?
Yeah, there are. Yeah,
and they still call themselves still cholo.
I think so. I think there's a cholo pride.
I don't want to fucking.
Right now, they get bad rep though.
No, yeah,
because they just brain people at Dodger Stadium.
Oh, that happened.
Yeah, but
I grew up in New Mexico. I was there at the birth of the neo cholo renaissance.
Oh, really?
Sure. Back when it came back. Like, I think it was, like, I don't know if it was just invented in the 70s, but, like, there was a period where there's a lot of disco going on, a lot of Familari shoes, platform shoes, leather jackets, feather haircuts, and then, boom, all of a sudden, you know, just the work shirts with the T-shirts underneath, top button buttoned, bandanas, chinos.
Yeah, fucking, like an L.A. biker kind of thing.
Yeah, and that was, like, over. Disco was done. Cholos were here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've stayed.
Oh, that stuck.
Yeah.
I prefer it to the feather haircuts. I never liked it that much.
Well, it's there's a big struggle in the neighborhood, you know, for them to retain, you know, that they're either the indigenous people over there, and they were
right.
Kind of taken out by Dodger Stadium, and now they're being taken out by people who gentrify
everything.
Yeah,
you mean
yeah.
White people? Say it, white people.
No, well, I'm part of the problem too, I guess.
I felt that right when you got here.
I'm torn. I don't know if I should spray paint the yoga studio or join
class.
It. Someone did tag the studio there by the house. And
where do you live? Around here?
I live in Echo Park.
Oh, okay. So you're right over there by Dodger Stadium?
Yeah.
Bought a house?
No, I rent the house.
Oh. Well, you're not really part of the problem then. You're just sort of like, I'm just renting, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to the owner.
But the owner did want like a Latino person in the house.
Cover his ass?
Yeah, so I had to kind of Latino it up with his mom and stuff.
Oh, so he's Latino?
Yeah.
Oh, then it's cool. That's not gentrification.
Yeah, he has a weird obsession, though, with it.
With what?
He's always like, with the Latino, like, he's from Peru.
Oh, really?
But he kind of identifies with the Latinos in Echo Park.
Yeah.
And so he's always saying, like, oh, yeah, man. You gotta watch out.
Yeah,
guy got shot at the gas station, dude. I mean,
like those kind of instructions are just sort of like, just you gotta be paranoid, man, all the time. You never know where it's coming from.
That's exactly
when,
you have to
you
be
take
paranoid.
A walk, getting gas, boom.
Yeah, I saw a guy threatening it. Like, there's like this 50-year-old white dude in like a Volkswagen.
Yeah.
And this kid on a bike was like, I'll come back and shoot you. Yeah. And the guy was like, what the fuck? He couldn't believe it that someone would say that.
But he didn't come back, did he?
He didn't come back. No one stuck around, though. We all took off.
So your brothers were that much older. So you're a kid and they're watching SNL. I wonder do you remember what season it was that you first saw?
Well, it was probably like 78.
Mm.
Probably 77.
So early. How old are you?
I'm 40. I'll be 47.
Oh, so you're close to my age. I'm 50. Just turned 52. So that was like Bill Murray, maybe.
Bill Murray, yeah,
yeah.
Bill Murray and the Wild and Crazy Guys. And
yeah,
I ate all that up, and then they used to show them on like Wednesday evenings at 7:30. They'd do like the best of the week.
Mm.
So
they
would do like a little shortened version of it. And so that's where mostly I would watch and then do those bits at school the next day and
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Which were your, what were your first impressions of impressions?
Well, my first impression was Robert Stack, which is an impression of of Dan Aykroyd's of right. Robert Sacklage. Yeah. Like, I want to know what's going on. I want to know now.
Yeah.
You are listening to Unsolved Mysteries.
That's
my Robert Sack.
That's good.
But I thank you. And then, but I would.
And you were like what, 12?
No. It's 78. I was 8.
Wow.
Doing seven.
Robert Stack. Yeah. I was about 13 when I saw the first season of SNL, and it had an effect on me.
Did it blow you away or no?
Yeah, I used to do. I used to do the falls at school. I never did voices, but Chevy Chase. I used to set up sort of fairly elaborate ways to fall down.
Yeah, would you throw your books down the stairs and stuff?
I think it wasn't surprise falls. You know, I tried to do it, you know, in a way that was just funny.
Okay.
So like we'd set it up.
Okay.
It probably would have been better if I figured out how to do it.
Me and my friends, we were throwing books on the floor and stumbling downstairs.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So and the other students were like, "What the?"
And and if someone comes by and says, "Hey, knock it off," it's like, "Oh, I fell."
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you were a Chevy Chase fan too?
Yes. Yeah. All fan of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you knew then at 8 that you're like, "This is my future."
Not really, but I did really fall in love with making people laugh. I think I did little entertainment things for my parents, and I remember hanging out with my brother's friends and their girlfriends, and I would make the girls laugh, so I knew that was on the right track.
Did they used to get you like stoned, like older brothers would get like a cat stoned or something? Like, come here.
No, my oldest brother's a real straight, true blue guy, so he wouldn't do that. He'd protect me.
Oh, from the other brother.
Yeah, the other brother would do that. Yeah. My other brother made me drink like a quarter bottle of vodka one time.
How old were you?
At that time, I was probably like 12. And he's like, if you drink that vodka, it was New Year's Eve, if you drink that vodka, I'll give you $5. And I did, and he didn't.
And you threw up?
I threw up, yeah.
Good times. It's always a good first drinking story.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
And so you're entertaining your parents with voices, and did you set up shows and have the family sit on the couch, that kind of shit?
Yeah, that kind of shit. They would be in bed, and we would come into their doorframe as different characters and try to make them laugh.
Oh, that's
make
good.
A beard with cotton balls and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And did you get some laughs?
I did, and it kept happening. So, you know, there was a time where I didn't think it was believable. I didn't think that could be accomplished, that kind of thing.
What, to get a job
in
show business?
To get a job in show business, yeah.
So what did you set out to do instead initially?
I was thinking about joining the CIA because I spoke fluent Spanish. I thought I could be used.
And you just like, was this sort of like a patriotic duty? You just thought
maybe
it'd be cool?
It was, you know, because I'm not an American. I've never been an American,
right?
So to speak, I was trying to do my part.
Yeah, you weren't just intrigued with the idea of being a spook,
A spy.
Well, you know, I think they call them spooks.
Okay.
You know, the guys who, a spy is one thing, but, like, you know, the spooks are the ones that go down to places like Chile and overthrow the government.
Yes. Okay, then, I would have been on board for something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was a little Reaganite.
You were a little late on the Allende thing.
The Allende thing, I was, you know, the story on Allende, I didn't get it straight at first.
Your parents must have lived through that shit.
They actually left before that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good for them, I think.
I don't think because of it, but it just happened that way.
Well, he was like, he was one of the good guys, right? He was the guy that like socialized the copper industry. And then the Nixon administration said, fuck that guy. Let's take him out. Let's send a couple of CIA guys down there who speak Spanish. To take out the good guy.
Some Horatio types.
Yeah. You got a funny dude that can get into the presidential palace with his charm and jokes. Some guy maybe does a cotton ball beard.
I can still do that, by the way. I know Obama listens.
He did the one time he was in here. And that might be the extent of it.
The president sat in this chair.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
It is. I mean, he left his cup.
You're going to have to leave this thing to the Smithsonian.
Yeah. Or maybe they could just build a replica. I'll donate some stuff.
Just the stuff, but not the whole desk.
Yeah. I mean, they can have the stuff, but I think that it'd be just as credible if they... Well, maybe, you know, I don't think it'd be easy to sort of manufacture a replica of this. A lot of shit here that's kind of one of a kind.
Absolutely.
Like that hammer, that half a hammer, that had to be removed. They're like, that can't stay with the president.
Is this a murder weapon?
The knife had to go. Yeah, they were like, that goes out. Yeah, a lot of stuff had to be, we had to clean it up a little in here.
So they scissors.
No scissors. They didn't know what I was capable of in a moment of desperation.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah. It was cool. Secret Service. They were cool.
I had the same thought, though, when I met the president at SNL.
Yeah?
I'm like, wow, I can change the world right now.
Yeah. I had profound fantasies of assassinating Karl Rove when I was doing Air America Radio. We actually were at the 2004 Republican convention covering it from inside. And we were just sort of like, you know, on a break, or it was before or after the show, and we were in this back room, and Karl Rove was just walking by, no protection. I'm like, if I was, if I knew more about toxins, I could have prepared for this. Like, I had this fantasy of like having some sort of toxin that I'd made myself immune to on my hand, and I shook his hand, and then moments later, he had a horrendous coronary, and I just slipped out the back door as no explanation, and I would have probably saved the country. Because he was the guy running things for that 4 years.
You would have saved a lot of trouble.
There was a lot of
saying it's cool to assassinate people.
No. It's not cool, but we're saying that that at times it's necessary. Clearly not in the case of Allende. But Chile might have been okay with Allende. But Karl Rove, I think arguably, you know, a lot of people would side with me. I didn't do it. It was a fantasy. And I don't think there's anything wrong with using your imagination for that type of stuff.
No, what are you going to do? Tell your brain to stop working?
That's right. Just censor myself like that?
Yeah.
Could never happen to kill people?
We have to explore every option as human beings.
But you didn't go that far. You were just sort of like, you realized that like if you were a dark, evil man in that moment, you know, you could just...
Yes. Yeah. I could have snuck in with any kind of metal object because I was in the show that
week.
So
you could have been
costume.
Part of the sketch.
I could have gone to my dressing room, grabbed something from the and put it in my costume. I was dressed as SpongeBob.
Oh, SpongeBob could be dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to put in a SpongeBob.
And then, like, maybe if you did it, like, everyone would think it's part of a sketch, and you could, like, get away in that secret elevator.
You know, I know my way around there.
Yeah.
You know, from my years of working there.
Yeah.
Like John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I know my way around there. He knew his way around Ford Theater.
Yeah. I was there, though, when I saw the opening show this season. That was the only time I've ever been there at the show. And Hillary Clinton appeared, and it was heavy security.
Yeah.
A lot of Secret Service, a lot of guys looking around, you know, with that thing in their ear. That didn't happen when the president was there?
Yeah. Yeah, there were people there.
So I think it's safe to say it was a good call not to...
Yeah, very good call on my part not to. Because I tried to take a video of Paul McCartney rehearsing.
On your phone?
Yeah.
At SNL?
At SNL.
When you're on the cast.
No, I came back later, and they're like, oh, Paul McCartney's rehearsing, so I got in, and I watched it, and I would take a video of it, and some guy was like, give me your phone.
Like, and you're like, I was on the show.
No. He's like, I don't care, give me your phone. And he went through my phone, and like...
But that wasn't Secret Service, that's just what they do now.
That's just his, Paul McCartney's guy.
Huh.
The Obama's guys were great.
Yeah, take all the pictures you want. So, all right, so you were going to be in the CIA.
When did that dream die? When my brother in college started doing plays.
Oh, really?
He started doing plays in college.
The actor.
Yeah, and he started getting a little notoriety in Chicago theater, and I was like, oh, wow, okay, this can happen. You know, my brother doesn't have a job. He was really just an actor. And so that kind of inspired me to go for it.
Is he funny?
He's not that funny. he's funny, but he's not that funny. My other brother is the funnier brother.
The dating service real estate guy who might be working.
Yeah, the middle brother.
Yeah,
yeah.
He sounds like a funny guy. It's easier to be funny when things don't always go right. It's the only thing you can do. You're either going to go that direction or you're going to get
depressed. Well, I think he had the middle child thing too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, when I came, then everybody loves the baby.
Oh, look at a little baby.
Yeah.
And he just got overlooked.
Yeah.
Older brother was almost on his own.
Yes.
Middle brother was like upstaged by your ass.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tough break.
But he was good, though. It was kind of like having a friend in prison.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of knew all the, he knew all, you know, like.
The bad stuff.
You know, to break into cars and stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd burned his hair once, setting a car on fire for some mobster.
Really?
Yeah, so like he was definitely in a gang when he was in high school.
Oh yeah,
and yeah,
yeah.
And then he straightened out and
he's okay now.
He's okay now. Yeah.
So did you go to college?
I did. I went to. Oh, that's your kitty.
What is that? That's a kid. That's a real kid. It's not a kitty.
Oh yeah.
I don't know what it's doing in my backyard.
Oops.
That was my neighbor's kid. They don't have a yard. That just sort of, it's sort of sad and sweet in a way. They just have that deck out there. So this kid has, you know, grown up from zero to like four or five or whatever she is now, just playing on that deck. They have a little
she
pool
never
out there.
Out down the hill?
No, that hill's treacherous. The people that owned that place before, the they pulled up all the shrubbery from that hill and then mudslided away. And now they can't ever sell that house because they have to, you know, rebuild it. They got to put whatever.
So they got to put stilts on it.
They got no. The house is fine, but the actual hill needs to be retaining walled. But we don't talk about
it. Are you okay?
It.
Are we okay?
I don't know. Hope it doesn't rain. Yeah, no, I'm okay. I left my tree in.
They better take some pictures of this desk before
avalanche. Rubble. Maybe that's what they'll put in the Smithsonian. Thank God the president wasn't here when this happened.
Tragedy. Yeah, the Los Angeles.
A tough close call for the president who was there years earlier. Just missed it.
Could have changed the world.
Yeah. So you're in college. Which
so I'm
college?
In college? Columbia College in Chicago.
That's a good one.
I was maybe going to work in film, television, maybe behind the scenes in movies.
That's what your plan was?
That was my plan.
Taking classes so still, and holding things?
Holding cameras and, you know, and working at a TV station.
Yeah, coffee came out good.
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, and so did they have a TV station at the college?
They did, and then I realized kind of quickly that it wasn't really that good with technical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then around that same time, I took an acting class. And then around that same time, I saw a show at Second City.
Who was on that show?
Improv Olympic.
Oh, at Improv Olympic. Anyone we know?
No. Mm. No. Joel Murray, I'd been recently doing stuff there.
Uh-huh.
And Dave Pasquazi, who's now pretty well-regarded as an improv guru.
Uh-huh.
And so I saw it, and they were great and fun. And I figured, I thought I can do that. And so then I hung around and watched and took classes. And then... I just started hanging out at night, talking to other improvisers and drinking and hanging out, and eventually
really?
I just stopped going to college.
So you didn't finish?
No.
That's all right. You can go back, you know.
I can. It's not one of those things that I feel like I should go back and finish.
You don't think about it.
I'm okay. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I've talked to a few people that have that experience with performing where they see someone doing it and they're like, nah, fuck, I could do that. I never felt that way with comic.
Really?
With comedy. I'd watch comics and be like, holy shit, how the fuck do they do that? Like, it was like some sort of code I needed to crack. I can get up there and do that.
I guess I could see that about stand-up, because that's more rigid, and, you know, you need to kind of have a style, and you need to have jokes written, whereas improv, you can kind of bullshit your way around.
Yeah, throw the ball to the other guy. tapped out.
Easy.
Yeah. Tag.
You take it.
Yeah. So, when did you start taking improv?
In like 1990, maybe 89.
What were you, like 20?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I was 20, and when I got into Second City, I was 21, which is pretty young.
How does that happen?
You know, I was working with UCB guys.
With Matt and Amy and Matt.
Yeah, I took classes with Matt Walsh, and then I met then Amy and Matt came later. But I met Matt Walsh and Matt Besser.
Yeah.
And Adam McKay and I teamed up with those guys.
What's the other one's name? Ian.
Ian, yeah. Ian wasn't around yet.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was Matt, me, and Adam McKay.
What were you doing with Adam and Matt and Matt?
We were doing a show at a stand-up club. So we're doing sketches at a stand-up club.
But you were already in Second City?
I don't know if I'd been at Second City yet.
But you were taking classes?
Taking classes, yeah.
Okay. And you just met those guys?
And we met those guys, and Matt said, hey, why don't you guys join us, and we'll do a show. And then we did an Upright Citizens. Then we did what became Upright Citizens Brigade, which is called the Cerebral Strip Mine.
So that was the predecessor?
The predecessor of UCB.
Wow.
And then we took on Ian and Ali Farnakian.
I know that guy. What happened to that guy? He was like in New York. There was a small period of time where he was like the improv genius.
Yeah.
And then I did. And then I was always found him intimidating. Then I saw him a couple of times. So like, he's all right. And then nothing. And then commercials. A couple commercials.
Yeah, but he's opened up a theater.
Oh, great!
And bar that's pretty successful.
Oh, good.
In I think it's on the east side.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So for improv?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. So he became like an improv guru.
He did.
And he teaches?
And he teaches.
Oh, so that's the route. He's taking the Del Close route.
Yes.
Oh. So there'll be generations, maybe several years from now, it's like, fuck UCB. He's the real guy.
That's possible. That's possible. I always think that that's healthy for... What's his whole name again? Ali Farinacci.
Yeah, I liked him. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad we settled that.
He was a good guy. He was a good guy. He is a good guy.
Intense guy.
It was very intense. You know, his
so it's you, Ali, Matt, Adam.
And then Ian.
And then Ian came
in.
Ian
Roberts.
So this was... And what was the name of it again?
Cerebral Strip Mine.
Now, do you, like... are you considered? Are you credited with the birth of UCB?
Well, yeah, they do. They do. I'm one of the founders.
You are.
Yes.
You're on the plaque.
Yes, I think I am. Okay. And I'm on the board of I'm on a board
of UCB.
Of UCB guys.
The actual board hanging there.
with
a picture.
I call myself the fifth Beatle.
Ah.
So they're the UCB four, and I'm the fifth Beatle.
What happened with UCB? Because they went on to, you know, tremendous success, and they built the school, and now they're nationwide almost, right?
Yeah. What happened is that a few of us were taken by the Second City Chicago and put in the touring company.
Was that a weird decision to make? Were you and Matt? Did you have a sit down and go like, they were like, we're going places, man. You can go old school. And run around the country doing improv.
I guess maybe we had that conversation. I don't remember it, but it basically it came down to, do you want to stay at Second City, or do you want to come with us to New York?
Yeah,
and things were just going well at Second City, so I stayed.
And you got into the touring company?
I got in the touring company, and then I got into the ETC stage.
Wait, who was in the touring company with you? Were you there with Sudeikis?
This is before Sudeikis. I was there with Brian Stack.
Mm-hmm.
Miriam, Jerry Minor.
Oh, yeah.
You know Jerry Minor?
Yeah.
And that was in the ETC stage.
What's that?
That's like the next, there's a main stage that has 350 seats, and then there's a smaller theater next to it.
So you're in the small theater, and you're doing road gigs.
Yeah, you do road gigs, and then you graduate to one of the theaters.
How long were you doing the road gigs?
About 3 years.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
How many dates you do a year doing that shit?
Probably like 15, 20.
Uh-huh. And you just go to like bigger cities or, you know, churches?
Yeah, you go to Ohio and then do their big theater. And, you know, like we kind of, it's kind of interesting because we got to do a lot of the vaudeville theaters.
Uh-huh. Those old beautiful theaters.
Yeah.
And people come out?
An evening of Second City, yeah. And people came out. Another great thing is probably like going on the road for stand-up is you start learning to make everyone laugh a little bit.
Sure.
So it was
I never was good at that, the everyone thing.
No,
I was always pretty specific. Early on, very specific, literally like 5 to 10 people.
Well, you know, when I was on the show, I dabbled in that, you know, but if I had my druthers, I'd rather make less people laugh.
Sure. It came naturally to me. Making less people laugh. Yeah.
Good. And you didn't, you know, you weren't cocky and saying, I can do that when you first saw stand up. You worked on it. You knew that there was work involved.
Sure. I don't think I got, you know, sort of broadly funny until recently.
Is that right? I don't think so. I think you were well regarded.
I was well regarded, but a lot of times that regard is for like, oh, that guy, yeah, he's very specific. You know, he's brilliant,
he's out there.
But yeah, he's out there. He's a little angry. We're very well
like
regarded.
You can't put any real money behind
sure,
this guy.
Sure, right, exactly. Well regarded, respected by his peers, but he's not going anywhere.
Gotcha. Well, you definitely changed that up.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, thank God. But I'm actually, you know, not just because of the podcast, but I'm a better entertainer now. I don't think I saw myself as an entertainer. I resented people who laughed at me too easily. Yeah, okay. It was sort of like, you know, that wasn't even where it was supposed to be, the laugh. And then you realize like, oh, they're laughing at me because I'm making them uncomfortable. And then you're like, that's okay. And that's the first step to being funny to all people.
Yeah.
Look at the guy taking himself too seriously.
It's like when the Beatles quit touring.
Yeah.
You know, the people weren't listening to the lyrics anymore. They were just screaming.
Yeah, that was my problem. They were screaming inside. They were screaming, at themselves for spending money on this bad choice for entertainment.
I saw you a couple years before the podcast. Well, were you doing the podcast yet? You had just been through some kind of disaster, and you were in you were at Maxwell's in New Jersey, in Hoboken.
Oh, was that then for one of the Yola Tango nights?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Oh, that's right. Right. I remember that night. Yeah, it was ugly. I was full of anxiety. And it was not a good show to see. Was that funny?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I did. I had that thing where like, oh, I haven't been really watching this guy intently like I should be.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That was the night the Nationals showed up.
The National, yeah, they were great.
Yeah. I knew nothing about them. And I was like, this seems important to a lot of people. I had a good time that night.
That was a very fun night. You met, you talked to Sharpling.
Mm-hmm.
You and Sharpling ironed things out.
Well, yeah, it was the first time I think that me and Sharpling after actually kind of met officially in a way. I don't think we had shit to iron out, did we? Maybe I had met him before. I remember it was good to see him. I like Sharpling.
Yeah.
And we were all talking, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And I quit drinking, so while we were talking about quitting drinking.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and then you eat ice cream, and that I was eating ice cream
every day like that. Right.
Yeah.
Were you smoking a cigar? No.
We didn't smoke a cigar in New York, no, but we did here.
Out in the back deck with Dave Becky.
Yeah.
You still with Becky?
I am.
Oh, good for you. He's a good guy. I hear from him occasionally.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Yeah, I said I'm going to Mark Maron's, and he's like, all right, I'll come over too.
Yeah.
Well, all right. I'll ask him. I'll just meet you guys there.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Like, I'm going to get this done. Get back on the same page with Maron. Didn't end well with us. Just imposed myself on his porch.
And you were writing, something for the Montreal Comedy Festival.
Oh, right. That was a powerful thing.
And a lot of it had to do with Dave Becky.
He can take a couple hits.
Of course. Of course.
Dave, how's my hair, Becky? Why are you looking at me like that? Dave, am I fat, Becky?
He's going to love that.
Yeah.
He's going to love that.
He'll be all right.
Of course.
Of course. Yeah. No, I'm glad he's doing well. Like, you know, we're actually friends again. I don't think we were ever not friends. It was just sort of like, you know,
are you enemies with anyone?
Enemies?
Yeah.
From my side of it?
Adversaries, let's say.
I think there's maybe one or two out there. Like, I imagine there's a few of the newer generation. Like, I probably have some new enemies that you don't know of? Right, they're one-sided. Like, fuck that guy. There's got to be a few of those guys out. It's my karma. I was a fuck that guy. So sure. I have to assume there's...
That's exactly what I say about the UCB.
Like, yeah.
We were saying fuck you to everybody, and now someone will come and say fuck you to UCB.
Oh, fuck, fuck them.
Yeah.
So you're doing these road gigs.
So I was there at Improv Olympic... And then I went to Second City, and I met Walsh at Improv Olympic.
Yeah.
So it was all kind of going on at the same time a little bit.
Sure. So, but did you meet Del Close?
I did.
Yeah. How was that?
It was, well, the first time it was kind of ugly because he was yelling at Matt Walsh, and Matt Walsh has always been a sweet, great guy.
And was he at Second City or was it a separate thing, Del Close?
It was a separate thing.
Right.
Eventually, they became friends. Second City became friends with Improv Olympic, and then they would take talent from there.
So Del Close was Improv Olympic?
Yeah, Improv Olympic. He and Sharna Halpern started it, and he trained a lot of the guys, Besser and McKay and all those guys. And so I was at Second City while they were doing.
But he's like the wizard.
He is like a magical wizard of improv.
Yeah,
I don't really subscribe to that.
Yeah.
As much, but.
Very respected. Well-regarded.
Well-regarded, yes. Didn't make them all laugh. Mm-hmm. It made some very important people laugh.
But yeah, but people love that guy. What was so special about how he approached it? Did it resonate with you when you met him? It was ugly because he was yelling at Matt Walsh. What was he yelling at Matt Walsh?
Because he hadn't paid for classes yet.
So he's like, yeah, bring a check next time you come here.
It was. I thought you were going to lay down some improv genius.
Oh, no. It's all about.
So do you go like
classes?
Hey, next time you better bring a check.
Yeah.
And scene.
It's a scene.
Get out. I'm saying no. I know it's against everything I believe in, but no, you cannot improv today.
And then later, I have to show the there's another side to Del.
Uh-huh.
Later in a bar, I uttered this phrase or this sentence. I wish I had $5 so I can buy beer. And he heard me and he said, are you going to buy beer with it? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, okay. And he bought me a pitcher of beer. And later it was a very sweet romantic thing as he looked at the screen and it was Farley and Tim Meadows. And he goes, you know, I taught those two. And that was it.
God, he was a genius.
He was. Yeah. He was. Well, actually, you know, he did. He kind of forced Second City's hand and put Farley and Tim Meadows in the cast, where usually they would take from within. He's like, if you want me to direct, I got to take these guys.
Oh, so he went to Second City and actually directed there. I should know more about that.
Yeah.
And Farley and Meadows were his picks.
Yes.
Oh,
and they were Improv Olympic guys that were taken from Improv Olympic and just put directly on a stage, so they didn't have to tour.
But he invented the Herald, right?
Yeah, he invented the Herald. That Herald, what it does is just it forces you to kind of write in your brain a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like it uses conventions that writers would use, mm-hmm. and they're kind of built in. And so that's why I think improvisers are good writers on the fly.
Oh, right. And sometimes when you improvise, you can build sketches out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel like now it's kind of built in how they're made. And so, you know, that's kind of what he was really good at.
So what happened next for you at Second City? So you get into the small stage after doing the road for 3 years. Now you're on the small stage.
I'm on the small stage, but you know, you only work 4 days on the small stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was great. Mm-hmm. And I got to improvise after each show. There was an improv set. So that's kind of where I learned to get good at improv.
Uh-huh.
Before that, I was pretty decent at sketch. And so that's where it happened for me. And I was lucky, you know, timing. Tina Fey was married to Jeff Richmond, who mm-hmm. was my musical director at Second City. So I worked with him and wrote songs with him. So Tina was very aware of me.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were times when I wanted to quit, and I talked to her, and she's like, don't quit, because there's nowhere I can send people to see you, you know.
Right.
And so I stayed.
So it got pretty dark, huh?
Yeah, it got dark there, kind of just staying there, not moving up. I didn't feel like that the boss there really was...
At Second City?
Yeah.
You weren't standing out?
I was standing out in the back,
but
not standing up in the front, standing out for the front.
And you were drinking?
I was drinking a lot, and...
Were you like that guy? Like after the shows, like, let's go get drunk?
Yeah. I was probably less bro about it.
Yeah.
But definitely the same results.
You're more like, let's go get drunk.
Yeah, let's go talk about the show. Yeah. Why are we so sad? Isn't that funny?
Why can't I make my sadness more funny?
What happened? So that happened. I don't know. Some skin is on the mic here.
From you?
I hope.
Maybe I should clean that thing.
It's fine now.
Okay. Just don't put it in your mouth. Don't.
Well, I guess.
Don't.
People always tell you, put your mustache.
Get your mustache right on it.
Right.
Do they really?
Your mustache right on it.
Do they tell you?
Yeah.
I wish I could tell people that. I can't tell you how many people do not know how to use a fucking mic.
I know.
It's like, get up on it.
I hear you.
Yeah.
You got to do it for my podcast, too.
Yeah. And you don't want to be weird because you think they should know, but they don't. You don't want to just keep pushing it in their face. So I'm sitting here riding the fucking levels. Just to pick up people who are out here. It's like, I can't, what am I going to do with that?
And shoving anything in someone's face is going to be taken as a weird little thing.
Yeah.
So you should, let's tell everyone who does a podcast, just put that mic in your face.
If it's a good mic, especially these Sony SM7s, that I'll always take a free one. you got to get right up on them. They're made for that.
Yeah.
That's how you do it. There's a lot of room between the foam and the mic insides. So you're drinking, you're sad, you're telling Tina you're going to quit, and she says, don't quit, Horatio, you have so much to live for.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so SNL comes around a few months later, and they ask me and Rachel was on main stage. Rachel Dratch, they ask us both to audition.
Oh.
And so
what year is that?
1998.
Oh.
And the great thing is I had a few months.
Before the audition.
Before the audition. They told me it's going to happen because they came and saw me and they're like, yes. It's happening in the summer, but we don't know when. Then later they're like, it's in 3 months.
You could put some characters together.
Sure. And write some stuff.
Yeah.
And work on it.
What'd you end up writing and what characters?
I did Robert Stack. I did a character.
Because you thought Lauren would be like, oh, it's a throwback.
I really just didn't have impressions, and that was one that I had.
Mm-hmm.
It may have looked that way, like, hey, here's a nod to you,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah. Had you thought of that before?
I thought of that when I did Truman Capote.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, he'll know what Truman Capote is, and he'll know that this isn't like a modern reference at all, and he'll probably like it.
Yeah.
So I did Truman Capote.
Robert Stack, Truman Capote.
Meatloaf, I sang like Meatloaf. I wrote a little song that I don't remember, but I wrote a little song for me, as Meatloaf.
Yeah.
And then I ended up getting the gig.
So, whoa. So where'd you audition?
In 30 Rock on home base.
For him.
He's there with Adam McKay.
Who's the head writer at the time?
Who's the head writer at the time. Yeah. And Tina, who's up there. And I think maybe Shoemaker and Higgins. And they're at a table. and you do the thing, and you know, there's a camera without a cameraman on it, and it has a light on it, and they're like, that's beamed to New York City, and it's beamed to Chicago, beamed to Los Angeles, and executives are watching this. So
really?
Yeah. Yeah. And you hear this all the time, but the guy says they're not going to laugh, so don't let that throw you. And then when they do, you're like, oh, wow.
I got
I'm
it.
I'm the one that did it.
Yeah.
I'm the one that broke them. So then you're just flying high after that.
Did you get laughs?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I got some good laughs, and I remember thinking afterwards, like, well, fuck it, you know? I mean, I was drinking and just was madly drunk that night after the audition, but I felt really good because I always wanted to make sure that audition, I didn't blow it.
You know, right.
Other auditions I've blown, and so many I can't even talk about, but that one I was like, well, I want to give it my best shot so I can say one day, hey, I gave it my best shot. I wasn't fucking drinking and fucking around when I...
Right.
So I checked into New York a couple days early. You know, they were going to have me come the day before the audition. I was like, no, New York's too crazy. Bring me out, you know, 3 days before.
Yeah.
And then I put myself up at a hotel.
So already they're, oh, you put yourself up. They weren't like, ah, this guy's demanding.
No. Oh, yeah. I knew that. I knew not to do that. So I put myself up. And then I was basically like Martin Sheen and, you know, in the hotel in Saigon. You know, I just locked up in there and kind of just put my work on the wall and my scenes, and I got it all. You
doing
know,
weird Tai Chi and drinking and breaking mirrors, getting bloody.
There was about 3 days of that. And then I was like, all right, let's go. Let's do it.
Wow. So, and you nailed it.
And I think I nailed it.
Yeah. And when did you find out you were on? Did you have to go to a meeting with Lorne?
Well, about the funny things about Lorne, you know, you interviewed him. He calls me into his office, and I have to wait like an hour and a half to talk to him. And come in, and we start talking about baseball. He's like, talking about the Cubs.
Yeah.
He knows I like the Cubs, so he's talking about the Cubs. And he goes, you know, Bill Murray's son is named Homer. And so
that was the first line.
So we're having this talk about Bill Murray's son is named Homer after Ernie Banks, and then he says we think we want to use you for this season, and so I'm like, oh, okay, all right. I'm like, well, I live with my parents at the time, and I said, well, can I tell my parents I have to move to New York? And he says, yes, tell them you have to move to New York, but don't tell them you'll be on the show. Because we don't know yet, you know, like, oh shit. So I couldn't even sell it. I didn't even know what that was yet. I couldn't say like shake his hand. I kind of just left with like, okay. All right, I think that's good.
So they wanted you as a writer?
No, so we say goodbye.
You're
very
in the
pleasant
bullpen?
And then the next day I meet with Higgins and other writers that hung out with Higgins there, and they were kind of making sure that I wasn't a dick.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I went home, and when I got home, I got the call, and Lorne told me I got the job.
Okay.
So that's when I screamed. That's when I hung, thank you very much.
What did you do? And you call your parents?
I was in the house with my parents.
Oh.
So I was screaming, and they're like, what happened? I'm like, I got it. I got the fucking show. Yeah. It is glorious.
Were they happy?
Absolutely. Well, they're a little sad because I was moving out.
Right. But you were 30, so.
I was 28. So they're like, he has to go, you know? And I'm like, ah, SNL taking me out of my womb.
I had a good gig here. Mom was cooking.
And who knows? You know, maybe I would have become a guru myself. You know?
you could have been well-regarded.
Yeah. Instead, I had to go out and get popular and be on SNL.
Yeah. So you were there for?
I was there for 8 years.
It was eight?
8 years, yeah.
That's a long run.
It was a very long, fun run.
You did a lot of shows, and who was on the cast when you got there?
I worked a lot with Farrell and Kattan and Sherry and
you were kind of sweaty, and your hair was, you had no beard.
I had no beard. I was about 80 pounds heavier.
Right.
Yeah, and my hair was always kind of sweaty.
But did you work right away?
Kind of. Yeah. Well, the great thing is that Smigel wrote a bit for me my first show where it was. The Best of Horatio Sands. So they shot this thing that was comprised of rehearsal footage from the 8 o'clock show. So that was supposed to air my first show,
right?
Which ended up airing the second show for time.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of helped because my name was out. Now my name's being said, and now they're making fun that this guy's so new that they're making that tape.
Right.
So, I did Ozzy, and that kind of was a big one. I did the Meatloaf, and that kind of got a big response. So I kind of snuck in with my musical impressions and And then I started working with Jimmy, and people liked us together. And
right.
And well, we thought, well, we didn't really plan on breaking, but we kind of made a thing of.
You were always
trying to fuck
up.
With each other.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of established, right, by Farrell, and, you know, and like, he broke a lot, and Jimmy always broke, right?
Right, and Jimmy, I mean, Jimmy's, like, you know, he's such a fan of Sandler that, you know, he auditioned at Sandler, too. He did Sandler.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, that was him and Farley's shtick, so I think that's kind of, it rubbed off on us, and I was like, yeah, more of that, more of the silliness.
Because it's
like,
contagious. Because I could feel in that room, it's not necessarily the warmest room, the studio. Like, yeah. it can get quiet in there. Like, I can see how, like, being in, you know, when there's an electricity to it, it must just get, like, amazing. Because, like, when I was there, I was like, this isn't an easy gig. I mean, it's intimate, more intimate than I thought. And, you know, the audience is right there, but and everything's moving in real time. But things can fall flat.
Yeah, they often do.
Yeah,
and
you can feel it. I felt it as an audience guy and just as a guy who's on stage all his life.
Yeah, and so, you know, yeah, you have to, that crowd isn't a regular slice of America crowd.
Right.
You know, it's executives and friends and entertainers, and so it's not the warmest crowd.
Yeah. So I imagine if you're having fun, then it just kind of rubs off.
Yeah, and now that I think of it, I have to say, you know, we had Will Ferrell probably opening up every show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we probably had a great Will Ferrell sketch or Catan and
right.
doing something huge. So the audience, by the time we got on, the audience were already kind of laughing.
And so were you buddies with Will and everybody?
Yeah, everybody. I didn't like Catan, his comedy, so much when I was with him.
Yeah.
But I always did like him.
Yeah.
And continue to like him. And
yeah, I saw him recently on a plane. He wasn't funny. He said hi, though.
Well, if you guys would have talked, he would have been funny.
No, I'm sure he would have been funny. He's you know, he's naturally funny fella.
Yeah.
So how bad was the booze during the time?
I mean, I was pretty functioning.
Yeah.
Apart for the booze got pretty bad after the show.
Now, what happened?
That's all
so
I
you're
had.
On 8 years. That's a long run. Did you, how did it end?
During that, my final year, that eighth year, I'd sat in for Tina on Update for a couple weeks, and so there was a audition to see who would be with Amy Poehler on Update.
Yeah.
So I talked to Lauren. I said, well, after I audition for this, hopefully I'll get it. But if I don't, you know, I'll probably leave this year. And he said, oh, we don't like talking about that. About stars leaving, we don't like talking about that.
Uh-huh.
So I took that as okay. I guess I'll stick around. And since since it wasn't something that anybody came up to you and say, hey, it's done.
Yeah,
you kind of hang out for a while. And you're like, wait a minute. Like, am I done here? And so what?
What
ended
you
up
just start getting written out or?
Well, this is before the show started.
Right. Oh, okay.
But so what happened is someone released something to the press saying that I was let go. And so I called up Shoemaker and asked him, like, did this happen? And he's like, no, man. I don't know where that's coming from.
Oh, no. Show business
so then
is
I'm
the
interviewed,
worst.
So then I'm interviewed by some radio station. They're like, well, what's up, man? Are you fired? And I'm like, well, I don't know, man. I think it's some executive just talking some shit or something,
yeah.
Which that wasn't the case. It was an executive probably who just wanted me out. But at that time, after 8 years, you make a lot of money at SNL.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't make sense to keep guys around that long.
Right.
Where for what I was making, you can hire three new people.
Right.
So, you know, I knew that for 8 years is a very long time. It's up there in years for a lot of people. So I knew it was time to go and it was okay. But just the way it happened was a little disappointing.
So how did you track it? What happened?
So eventually, my managers called up Lauren and Lauren's like, yeah, you know, it's the money thing or something. And,
uh-huh.
And you know, and I think he may have tried to hold, you know, to keep me, but at the end, he's just like, well, you know, 8 years. And
well, when I talked to him, he seemed to feel that, like, it seems to me that he likes knowing if someone's going to go either by his choice or someone above him's choice, he feels better if he thinks you're okay.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You know, he'll do fine. You know, people know him. He'll work.
And if you think about it, I mean, he has the responsibility of a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
Not just those people that work for him, but, you know, the expectations of what that show should be.
Right.
Even now, people are asking me, what about Trump? You know, what's Lauren going to do about Trump? And so now Lauren has to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, what? How did you leave feeling about him?
I just felt like I really would have liked. Thank you for letting you go. I really would have liked that.
Have you called him?
Oh, I have. I have talked to him since.
Oh, you have.
It's good. Yeah. Now I'm working with his company, Broadway Video. So I'm back in contact.
Did you get your closure?
I'm still dealing with my closure. Yeah.
But did you say to him, I would have liked.
Well, you know, I kind of threw I shot some arrows his way, trying to get his attention. Like I said, Jim Downey was the Karl Rove of SNL, and that they were too far on the right all those years when we could have really been hitting the Bush administration, that they kind of dropped the ball on it.
Yeah.
And that Will inadvertently was such a cool, fun guy that he probably swayed the election. And so I was saying that the show
Bush's
wasn't...
In Bush's favor?
Yeah,
I
think so. I think people, if you think about the margin of that election, it's not that preposterous to think that he could sway the...
More people liked him because of Will's impression of him?
Yeah, and it would mean seeing Will every week.
Yeah. They were that calculating?
Maybe.
I don't like the guy,
but subconsciously, if you're on the fence already...
Yeah, I want to see more Will Ferrell doing George W. Bush, so let's elect that monster. Wow.
And so so when they interviewed me for this book... I'm the one that always says stuff that gets printed. And so I recently said, you know, I don't hate the show. I'm not just here saying shit against the show. I just think that a little dissension's good for the Republic sometimes.
Yeah.
And that I felt that the show wasn't, for those years, it wasn't being run under the, you know, how the initial show had been run. With some teeth and some rebellion, with some fuck you to society. You know, it was just becoming too much like, what? The people on this show don't feel the way you're feeling, so how come, you know, Jim Downey is able to write these sketches that no one's identifying with? And so, I recently came into contact with him to tell him, like, hey, nothing personal. And he was very nice back. And
who, Downey was? Or Lorne?
Lorne.
Yeah.
I really do think Downey's a super talented dude.
Yeah.
I just don't like that he's a Republican.
Right.
And I think that his years at SNL when he was the head writer were probably the best. So it's nothing against his talent.
Right.
I just don't
You
I
just
don't
want
like
a little
politics.
More edge.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, you know, Seth Meyers was writing the edgy left stuff. And he was having to do battle with this guy. And usually this guy would win because of his seniority.
Ah. But you never got a sense. Well, how are you with Downey?
Oh, I think he knows that. I think he knows that I didn't like that about him.
Yeah.
I hope he knows that it's not personal to me. He doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. Well, that's what you find. When you're like, you know, Goliath is not being affected by your slingshot.
Yeah.
You're sort of like, I think Goliath's okay.
Yeah. He's not throwing anything back at me, so that's okay.
I'm going to keep
He's
throwing
rocks. Stepping
rock.
On me.
But you're working for Broadway Video now, because I know you went through a time... So after the show, how bad did the drinking become?
Well, I had sleep apnea, a sleep apnea operation. I broke up with my girlfriend at the time, and then I got fired. So I had like this, you know, perfect storm of horrible stuff happening.
Yeah,
and I just got really depressed, and then I started dating someone, and I thought, well, if I don't stop drinking, I'm going to ruin this relationship like I have in the past.
What kind of drunk were you? Sad or angry?
Both. But I'd be very gregarious and fun to a certain point. Then I would become an asshole, I assume.
Right. Morose.
Fuck you. Jealous. Bitter. Yeah, jealous was the worst.
All that truth coming out.
Yeah. Too much truth.
Yeah, yeah. Too much truth no one seemed to want to hear.
And
you quit?
And I quit.
You doing the thing?
I quit. No, I didn't do the thing. I did actually do the thing when I started. Eventually, I got a little... I didn't feel it was doing me any good.
Right. And so you just kind of got grounded and stayed off it, huh?
Yeah, and I started seeing a therapist who specialized in addictions, and so that was really good for me, too.
Oh, that's great, because I remember you were over at, like, I know people, when you're on SNL, and then, you know, they don't see you for a while, they're like, well, that didn't... wonder what that guy... How'd that go? Yeah. And I remember when I went over to Maker, you know, that that weird internet factory.
you're like,
they're trying to get me to do the podcast or do something over there. And you're like, yeah, Horatio's here running everything. And you were, I just remember seeing you in a room with a board. There's a lot of ideas. And I'm like, what's going on? You making stuff? Well, no, not really. It's all going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. They put me in charge of doing all these productions. And then, well, what happened there was they were trying to sell it.
Yeah.
So we didn't really make a lot of stuff.
But you got paid.
I got paid. Yeah, I got paid. They were nice to me.
Uh-huh. And then, and so what happened after that?
So I've been in and out of failed pilots and movies and some,
working,
some
you're getting shots.
Working.
Yeah, yeah,
you're always
yeah.
getting some shots in.
Yeah.
And
well, you look good.
Thank you. Thank you.
And
you
too. Well, thanks. So what's the thing you're doing with Broadway Video?
So now we're doing, I'm gathering up the comedy for a digital platform called Más Mejor,
mm-hmm.
More Better,
mm-hmm.
and it's a playoff of Above Average,
mm-hmm.
Lauren's internet site, and so it's for millennial Latinos.
Oh, good.
And so I'm gathering up a lot of Latino talent that I'm finding,
yeah,
and putting them onto this site,
yeah,
and partnering up with Telemundo to do this huge monster site.
Wow, so you're like in competition with Al Madrigal.
I am, yeah. Well, actually, I welcome Al Madrigal's assistance. It's not an easy task getting all this funny Latino stuff out there.
Got to get Madrigal. Madrigal's
absolutely.
Like,
I'm in contact with Madrigal.
Okay, yeah, he's the Don of that. He's the guy.
I mean, I hope Madrigal can get me and Fluffy together. But me and Madrigal are cool, for sure.
Fluffy just got his own show, so I don't know, man.
Well, maybe he'll do a little bit, a little video. I'll go to him.
Go to him. Say, like, are your shorts on? Put on the shorts. Let's do a thing up front.
You think he doesn't wear shorts?
He always wears shorts. Just maybe at home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is bit. He wears the jorts, the long shorts.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and then, Yeah, I think Fluffy will do it if you just say he can, push his merchandise. He'll be fine if you can get the Fluffy merch out there.
We can do that.
Okay. Well, this is, I guess, a public call. To Gabriel Iglesias and
and all funny Latinos out there.
All funny Latinos.
Can submit stuff to me.
Yeah, Horatio needs your submissions. In Spanish?
In English or Spanish.
Whatever, any way you want to do it.
Whatever floats your boat.
Yeah. And now Madrigal is giving his seal of approval of this. You're not going to alienate Madrigal.
No.
If you do some stuff with Sands.
You're not going to share on Madrigal. And it works both ways.
Yeah, buddy.
You can work with Madrigal, and I'm cool with it.
Yeah. Oh, look at that, man. This is this is an open door.
Brothers, man.
Oh, right
on. Raza.
All right. Hermano? Is that
Hermanos,
it? Hermanos,
yeah.
Yeah. Good talking to you, man.
A pleasure. Thank you.
That's it. That's me and Horatio. Sweet guy, good guy, funny guy. Had a really nice time. Some of you ask questions about this part of the podcast, like why do things end abruptly sometimes? Because sometimes, most of the time, I'm not hearing the end of the podcast, so my tone might be a little different. The end of the conversation. Like, I do this stuff after I record the interview, so I don't want you to feel like I'm being rude or weird or my temperament is different. It's just sometimes this part of the show is not recorded at the same time. You know what I'm saying? But I love it. The Horatio on Earwolf is Horatio's podcast. You can go to WTFpod.com, get yourself some justcoffee.coop or some posters or leave a comment. Or I'm really hung up on this fucking volume pedal, on this repeater pedal.